It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My 15-minute story and opinion shows John Max Radio Rants. I may also be accessed by going to the website. Once again, www.johnmack13.com and clicking the John Mack Radio Rants tab for the next shows. Unlike this show, that show has no regular schedule, but it's produced as the spirit moves me. My guest next week is the Reverend Al Neese, an Episcopalian, the minister who once served under the well-known John Shelby Sprong in Newark, New Jersey. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight is writer, editor, educator, and technologist Stephen Cherry. I first met Steve about 25 years ago when we were first members and then officers of the New York Amateur Computer Club, now the second oldest continually functioning computer club in the country. The audience should understand that amateur in this context means neither beginner nor non-professional, but rather enthusiast. Many of the members were employed in the field. It was a bit confusing in those days, because as we had another active member in office of the late Steve Terry, and people would say, "Ask Steve, he knows." Or, "Why don't you ask Steve Terry?" In those days, Steve Cherry was looking for his niche either as a technologist or a writer-editor. Since then, his career has moved in quite a number of interesting directions. We'll explore all of these in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Steve, and welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Queens, New York. And I went to school there and then in the Bronx at Bronx High School of Science. I went to college in Western New York, Geneseo College, then the University of Iowa for graduate school the first time in philosophy. And the second time years later, I got an MFA at the New School. So it's a little weird. I went to the best school in the country for creative writing, but not for creative writing, and I have a degree in creative writing, so that's the short of it.
The Bronx High School of Science, what you get out of this, some very interesting people went there, obviously, not only technologists, but Bobby Darin and Stokely Carmichael.
It was a pretty great place. You know, you walk into the building and the upperclassmen tell you all about the pool on the fourth floor. There is no fourth floor. And that's your home for the next few years, Bronx High School of Science. It turned out to be a good place for pretty much everything. I think my favorite two teachers were both social studies teachers. And it's a good place in New York to get an education. New York is pretty lucky to have these special high schools, Stuyvesant, Hunter College High School, Brooklyn Tech. They're all great schools, and they draw from, you know, a pool of plenty of kids, so it's pretty easy to find like-minded, geeky individuals to hang out with.
What led you to choose Geneseo, fairly far upstate?
It's I started out in engineering, and they had a what they called the 3-2 engineering program with the University of Buffalo. So you spent 3 years at Geneseo and then 2 years at Buffalo, physics first in, at Geneseo and then engineering at Math. And you come out with bachelor's degrees in both fields. I'm not sure it's a great deal. Like in 5 years, you could get a BA and a master's probably or come pretty close to it. But that's how I started. I found engineering wasn't my niche, even though it was my father's profession. And I stayed with math. So I had a double major in philosophy and math at Geneseo, partly because it was easier to tell my father that I had switched to math than that I had switched to philosophy, and partly because I was in this special math and science housing that I didn't want to give up because it was in a building, a dorm building, with the upper two floors were the special math and science housing, and the lower two floors were all women. So that made it a pretty good place to live. So I technically was a math major who fulfilled all the requirements of a philosophy major as well.
Yeah, how'd you happen to marry philosophy to math? A lot of people might not see the connection, although the ancient Greeks were obviously both philosophers and mathematicians.
Yeah, you know, some people think it's the most logical thing in the world, and other people find it baffling. I was one of those guys who had equal scores within 10 points on the SAT for math and English, and I just sort of refused to choose. I've pretty much refused to choose my whole life. I've done some computer programming, but I've done some creative writing. I'm an editor and a writer, but of technology mainly, and I taught both too. So both creative writing and computer programming. So I'm one of those lucky people who never had to choose. I've just always combined the two.
What did you do after college?
It's kind of a weird turn of events. My cousin was a licensed custom house broker, and I right after college I went to a teach, although I hadn't gone through the whole teaching certification thing. So I taught at a private school that didn't require certification. There again, by the way, I applied for a position teaching English. They liked me very much. I was their first choice, but they said they also had a math position open, and they had another applicant for English that they liked not as much, but they had one, and they didn't have anybody else for math. So if I would take the math position, they would hire that other person for English. So there again, not choosing. But then
was that in New York, Steve?
That was in Brooklyn. It was a very cool little school in downtown Brooklyn that no longer exists. It's called Borough Hall Academy. And it was a private school, but not what you would expect when you hear private school. The students were mostly the children of working class, parents living in some pretty crappy neighborhoods in New York, in Brooklyn. Ocean Hill, Brownsville, Bedford-Stuyvesant, East New York. And these were parents who chose to spend basically all of their available income on educating their kids instead of sending them to the local school. So it was a very cool school because the parents were totally motivated. You know, the first day, after about a month maybe, I didn't assign homework, and there were 3 phone calls to the school. Like, my kid says there's no math homework. I know he's lying. What's the math homework? It was the last time I didn't assign at least a few problems.
Yeah, I remember that I felt even with how important parents' motivation was, but I remember feeling that sometimes that works a disadvantage of other people. I remember during the budget cuts on the Beam, they cut a whole lot of stuff out of the schools. And at that time, my kids were in a grammar school in Riverdale, and they immediately said, the Parents Association says, well, we'll buy the VCR and we'll pay for the extra library aid. And it was great for my kids, but kids in poor neighborhoods, they weren't getting this this additional parents throwing in thousands of dollars. And I felt both good about that and I felt bad about that, you know.
So. I have to say the way we fund schools, mainly in the United States with property taxes, is just a very bizarre system that really perpetuates a lot of the inequalities that have existed for a long time. I'm not a big fan of it. It's and I'm not a big fan about the way we underfund education in general. It's something we've gotten away with for a couple of decades at least, maybe since the 70s here in New York. At some point, the chickens are going to come home to roost. We, meaning the United States, are kind of a middle-of-the-pack place now when it comes to educating the next generation. And it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea for the kids. It never was a good idea for the kids. And now it's not even a good idea nationally as policy.
But this wasn't property taxes. It was all in New York. It was just parents reaching for a checkbook that in other neighborhoods they might not be able to do that. And I felt that was both good for my kids but unfair, you know?
Yeah, the net result is the same, right? If you can afford to shell out one way or the other toward your kids' education, then your kids are going to get a better education than kids whose parents can't. And there's very little that, you know, in the long run has been done to redress that. We tried busing and all sorts of other solutions. It's still the case. It's still the case that in New York, even though we don't have property taxes in New York City, it's neighborhood by neighborhood. And it's, you know, wealthier neighborhoods have better schools, and less wealthy neighborhoods have in some cases, very bad schools. And it's not a good system for educating a generation of people.
How long did you teach for?
I taught for just a year, and my cousin said to me one day, you know, you're working at that school for very little money. Why don't you come and work for me for very little money? And that was, of course, an offer I couldn't refuse. So I became a licensed custom house broker, which I did for about 5 years. A customs broker acts as an agent, really, although technically it's a broker, for importers, bringing their goods through U.S. Customs and any other government paperwork, FDA, for example, Department of Transportation, whatever, getting their goods through customs and to their warehouses or wherever their showrooms or whatever. That, in an odd way, led me to computer programming because my cousin, U.S. Customs, this was back in the 1980s, U.S. Customs went to all the brokers and said, we're going to automate. You have to automate. You have 18 months to get your business ready. At the 12-month mark, you're going to file your paperwork electronically optionally. And 6 months after that, you're going to file it electronically in a mandatory way. So most brokers went out and bought systems at that time. There really wasn't much going on in terms of commercial systems based on personal computers. So most brokers ended up contracting with vendors for mini computer-based systems, mostly digital equipment systems, and software that was written by people who, you know, we're writers of software, but not in that industry. And my cousin and I thought this was a terrible idea on many counts. The software was not likely to be good. It was going to be expensive. You were completely at the mercy of the vendor. And he had had one programming course in college. I had none. But he said, we should do this ourselves. We're smart guys. We can do this. And he got a copy of DBase 2, I think it was at the time. I don't even think it was DBase 3. That ran on CPM, the operating system that preceded MS-DOS, which was the operating system that preceded the very first Windows systems. And he wrote all the database stuff. I got a copy of Turbo Pascal and started writing all of the non-database stuff, all the sort of office utilities that would connect up with the database. And that brought me to the New York Amateur Computer Club, which you mentioned earlier. And so I started programming in that context. I had very, very clear objectives. I had to write the software for our business, and I needed help. I bought every computer programming magazine I could find. I bought books. I bought Turbo Pascal, had some great tutorials built right into it, and I had the help of people like Steve Terry, who you mentioned, who was a Turbo Pascal genius, and guys like you, who just sort of knew computers in general. And that got me started down the computer programming road, which I'd never been in college or anywhere else.
That was one of the early electronic, they called it data interchange, really document interchange requirements. The federal government then went on and on and on with that, and people like Walmart. It was one of the earliest times that they mandated that you take away the input. People used to mail documents in, and they used to have key punches, have to punch it in, and they have to verify it. And by doing it this way, number one, they reduced their payroll, and they put that on you, just the way Amazon does when you order online or paying bills. Now, it's obviously helpful to you because you're in control, and if there are any errors, you've made them. But it was kind of the beginning of this whole thing that you and I will talk about later about replacing jobs. So did you enjoy it? Did you really enjoy the programming?
I have to say I really did, John. I resisted learning computer programming in college because I had a pretty good idea that I was going to love it. It just looked like it was kind of my, just sort of work with my mindset. And I wanted a really broad liberal arts education. I tried to do a minor in dance. I got pretty far in that. I took courses all over the university. I graduated in 3.5 years instead of 4 with something like 157 credits instead of 124. I really had a great time in college, and I didn't want to get diverted into this potential obsession. In fact, my mentor in college was this guy, Bill Edgar, in the philosophy department, and his wife, Stacy Edgar, taught computer programming. She had a PhD in physics from Syracuse. Back then, there weren't many PhDs in computer programming, and she got hired by that department. And she kept saying, take this course, take that course. And I knew she was a great teacher. I would have been happy to take a course with her, but I just didn't want to do that. She would say, take my Lisp course. I'm teaching Lisp. It's not even computer programming. It's AI. You'll love it. And I wouldn't do that either. So sure enough, I started programming, and it became pretty obsessive. It was just one of those – it might have been the first thing that I did where I really got into, that kind of flow where you look up and it's 4 in the morning and you just have no idea that it's anywhere past 11 p.m. And it's like you've – probably taken a bathroom break a couple of times. You don't even remember them. You suddenly realize you're starving, and you've been programming for 9 or 10 hours straight.
I was an English major, and I kind of spent my college years doing what I wanted to do. I had fairly a non. I just kind of skated along, and I. Unlike you, I took 5 years because I started as a philosophy major and then I switched to English. But I was reading books that I should have read 2 years ago or that I didn't have to read. I read a lot. And it was only after I happened to get into, by luck, the technology world that I would be up half the night just as you were, or I'd wake up in the middle of the night saying, I can do it this way. And it was, you just threw yourself into it totally. You're totally right. Now, my consulting firm did some consulting for a firm that you're working for, the foreign publisher of quality books. What was the name of that company, and what got you from the custom broker job to the publishing job there?
Do you mean Elsevier?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's nice to hear Elsevier's spoken of in flattering terms. It's normally in my current worlds, or my more recent worlds, it's generally called something like Evil Empire. And I would say it's both. It's a really great company, and it is also an evil empire. From the computer programming, I started to tack back toward the English world, I guess, in English language world. In an odd way, I became obsessed with desktop publishing, and Steve Terry, who we've mentioned a couple of times now, was a Turbo Pascal genius, but he was also the leading authority in New York and possibly the United States in a number of early desktop publishing technologies, including a program, Ventura Publisher.
I remember that, yeah.
And he got me started on that, and it was a wonderful program, I have to say, and the architecture of it is something that other desktop publishing systems of today still struggle to achieve in some ways. My only commercial piece of software was related to Ventura Publisher, but I started to learn more and more about desktop publishing, and with Steve, I did a couple of consulting gigs with him, and then a couple without him, and so I started teaching at a place called Electronic Directions that no longer exists in New York in the East Village, and one day somebody from Elsevier called Electronic Directions, which was a training and teaching place for desktop publishing, and I was teaching. I taught their WordPerfect class. I taught their DOS class. I would eventually, because of my gig there, write a book about WordPerfect. Brady was the publisher, and it was a series called Fast Access, and I wrote desktop publishing with WordPerfect, of all things. Elsevier called Electronic Directions, and they were looking for some freelance help with early, mostly brochures and flyers and things that they had been sending out for a lot of money, they thought they could bring that work in house with desktop publishing methods, and they hired me to do that, and I worked for them. You know, a few hours a week for maybe 6 months, and then all of a sudden, the head of the publishing production, a guy by the name of John Mancia, decided that, well, he'd actually been thinking about this for a while, apparently, that he was going to start a publishing technologies unit within Elsevier. And this was 1990, and it was still pretty early, and the main goal was to reuse author diskettes. Why are we rekeying all of this stuff when authors are doing their work on computers nowadays? Why can't we just get their, 360 kilobyte floppy diskettes, 5 1/4 inch diskettes, and get the text directly off of them? That sort of thing. And they also decided that they could also do some page layout, and they could do proofing. They bought a 600 DPI laser printer that did tabloid size sheets. It was the only one in existence. It cost something like $18,000. It was made by a company called Veritiper. It was the only thing in existence that did this. High resolution, large format. The thing was about the size of a coffee table. They bought that and a publishing system called Best Info that no longer exists. They didn't survive the transition into the Windows world because they thought OS 2 was going to be the way to go. But they had a wonderful system. It was a little bit like Ventura Publisher and different in some ways and really excellent kerning, excellent justified text, some really, really nice typesetting on the desktop. John Mancia decided he was going to create this unit. He was going to hire somebody. They were going to save a bunch of money. They were going to save more than they were spending on this person. And he knew that there was this freelancer working over in the marketing department. He interviewed me and took me on, and I started that. Eventually, by the time I left about 4.5 years later, it was a 6-person department. I was the manager and not just supervisor, and we were saving hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, which was all it took to justify the unit. We did a series of several series of books in house, page layout and page proofing, and a whole bunch of maybe by the time we were done, about 20 different journals were being done in house. That was a lot of fun. John, one of the cool things about it was we put in a very early local area network using Novell was the choice. 3Com would have probably been technically better, but Novell was easier to work with. And it was the first local area network that all of Elsevier had, and guys came from the mothership in Amsterdam to come and see what we had done, and they decided to start doing some local area networks in the home office. It was a fun time to be working with cutting edge technologies because everything was new, everything was hard, and everything was very satisfying when you got it working.
Yeah, that brings two things to mind. It was John that you introduced us to, and we did some consulting for him. We were also doing consulting at the time. Or about the time, I guess, for John Wiley, and that was really in spreadsheet and managing areas, but they were just beginning to hook Apple IIs up to their Linotypes. It was fairly interesting because people weren't doing that. You also mentioned electronic directions. I believe that Steve Terry used to arrange for us to have to have nighttime meetings or courses of special interest groups. I remember David Levine teaching the Pascal class there. And I also remember that they had one of the possibly three next computers in New York City, and someone broke in and stole it and was trying to sell it on the street corner saying that it was really his. And when the police said, yeah, right, and they traced it back to electronic directions almost before they knew it was gone. Do you remember that?
No, actually, I don't. But that's a great story. I mean, the number of next computers sold in New York was probably in the three digits. I'm just guessing.
And, yeah.
It would be a crazy theft to try and get away with. I mean, just ask the thief to boot the thing up and do something with it, and you'd find him out pretty quickly. That's
now,
a wonderful story.
It's interesting too. Next, as you said, we sold very poorly, but it was very important in two areas. First, Tim Berners-Lee developed the first web clients on a Next. And of course, after the hardware didn't sell, then Apple bought the company back for the operating system, and it was Jobs Part 2, and all of a sudden they were on top of the world.
Yeah, the Next device was extraordinary. It's kind of interesting that, you know, the history there, if we could talk about it for a minute. You know, Jobs had the Apple II series, and that was an amazing computer for its day, but he knew that it was just a tiny fraction of what computers could do. And he had heard that, you know, the guys at Xerox PARC had some amazing stuff, and he knocked on their door for 2 years before they let him in to see what they were doing. And what they were doing was, you know, all of the stuff that we understand today as modern computing, right? Graphical user interfaces, the mouse, laser printers, Ethernet, you name it. It was all developed there. But, you know, what they had created was this incredibly expensive computer that wasn't
right.
commercially viable, right? It was the Xerox Star was tens of thousands of dollars, or over $10,000, and nobody was buying that. And Jobs figured out, and this was the genius of Apple, and it certainly wasn't just Jobs, but, you know, he was like, we can do all of that and make it affordable. And the first Macintoshes were not cheap, but they were affordable, and they did sell, and Apple did very well for those years. And then he turned around and became Xerox PARC, right? I mean, he created this company Next that designed a brilliant, cutting-edge computer that did all of these things that we now take for granted, And came up with a system that was just way too expensive for anybody to buy in any serious numbers. He became the people that he triumphed over.
But it was interesting that he went to Unix and then he put the graphic user interface on. It was a very elegant system. I remember seeing him demonstrate it to a bunch of folks in New York, and I knew his style from Apple. And here he was in a three-piece suit, and he was very different, and he really wowed them. Of course, then they went home and they added up the numbers, and they didn't all buy. But I was at Dimension Star. I was at the I even forget the name of it. It's not around anymore. It was a computer show in Chicago. I was on my way up to Ben Rosen's conference up in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and it was when they showed the Xerox Star. And it was terrific. Everyone was going, now Apple was at the show. Apple also had a user group meeting there of the executives of various user groups around the country that I was at. The other thing that was very funny about that show, the Osborne One was introduced, and they had a spreadsheet called SuperCalc, and I was standing with Dan Bricklin, who was a friend, who was the co-writer of the VisiCalc, and showing it to and the fellow showing it to us. Now the fellow showing it didn't know who Bricklin was, and he's showing us this thing. So Bricklin says, "Does it replicate?" And the Xerox guy said, "What do you mean? I mean the SuperCalc." The awesome guy said, "What do you mean?" And Dan said, "Well, to copy all the formulas down." He said, "Oh, you can copy them down," but Dan said, "Did the references change?" And the fellow didn't get it. Now, by the time they got it out, someone had gotten it. But I found that hilarious. I was just standing there watching it. You know?
Yeah, that's it's amazing to me that people and people still do this today in various contexts, right? They create a piece of technology that does nothing but replicate what people are doing by hand and doesn't take advantage of the fact that the computer can do some things, you know, instantly, and why not build that in too? I mean, what would a spreadsheet be if the formulas didn't change when you added a row or whatever?
I was extremely lucky in that I had seen an Apple II on Ben Rosen's desk, and this is before any of the good software. He had a program from that tied by modem into the Farmers Weather Service down in Kentucky, and he also had some games and the Dow Jones Stock Market Analyzer. This was when Barbara and I were leaving Morgan Stanley, and so I said, "You ought to get one of those to fool around with." So I bought the Apple II, and then within 3 months, VisiCalc was announced, and people were jumping up and down to get training all over Wall Street, and then we were there. We had an early copy of the software. And then not only did that build a business for us, Popular Computing Magazine called Bricklin, and they asked him to write an article about VisiCalc and how it could be used, and he said, "Well, we really don't do that, but why don't you get in touch with Barbara McMullen? She knows more about VisiCalc for training than anyone I know." And Barbara and I wrote the first article, and then 30 years later, I'm still writing. So that was very lucky in two ways.
It's interesting that how that worked. I mean, I've heard that story so many times and in so many contexts. I mean, my cousin, before he in order to automate his business, before that he had bought an Apple II just to sort of fool around. It just seemed like it would be a useful tool someday, or something like it would be. The origins of the internet, involve a story that's not that different from that. The company that built the first message processing machines, BBN, Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, had a guy working for them by the name of Licklider, who was a psychologist of all things, And a company down the road, this very, very young company, Digital Equipment, in its earliest days, had come up with a somewhat affordable computer. This was back in the 1950s, very early 60s, had come up with a computer that, you know, didn't take an entire room. And he was like, we should get one of those things. It's going to be useful someday, and we should start, you know, learning about it. And that was their start in the computing world. And you know,
his son, I had met his son. His son worked for Software Arts, which is Brooklyn and Frankston's company that developed VisiCalc. So it's one of these things that just happens. Like if you remember, Gates's book, The Road Ahead. He said it was written about 1996, I think, or 1995, and he said the internet's going to be very important after 2000. And all of a sudden, it dawned on everyone that it was important now. And by the time he got the paperback out, he had changed the whole book, and he also had reorganized Microsoft. You know, so he was able to react to that.
Yeah, it's remarkable how quickly these things happen, and it's also remarkable how unquickly these things happen. Right? The lesson of technology is, you know, people overestimate the impact of technology in the short term, and they underestimate the impact of technology in the long run. So something comes along, and people think, oh, this is going to change the world in 5 years, and 5 years later, the world is hardly different at all. Even Google, 5 years after it started, had not made much of a dent in the way we do things. But in the long run, the impact of technology can be insane. A few years ago, when I was still at IEEE Spectrum, I walked into one of my colleagues' office, this guy who was a journalist, a tech journalist for almost 30 years. He started in Detroit writing automotive news for one of the big Detroit newspapers. And he was staring at his screen intently, and he saw me walk into his doorway, and he looks up, and he goes, I just have no idea how I did this job before Google. And he'd been doing it for 20 years before Google. So the impact in the long run, it can be incalculable, but most technologies don't have a huge impact right away. Very, very few of them do even. The telephone took 50 years to become ubiquitous. And that's more like the norm than the exception.
Yeah, but the window's changing so rapidly. I've seen one of the many things on this is on the internet, and it mentions how long it took these to reach X percentage of the companies, and they started with the telephone, and then with the television, and then with the personal computer, and then with the with mobile phones, and then with the iPod, and then with the iPhone, and then with the all of a sudden it's just going it's shorter and shorter and shorter till they reach maximums, you know.
Yeah, in some ways the rate of technological progress, the rate of change is increasing, right? So it's not just fast, it's getting faster more and more quickly, right? So,
oh yeah,
it's accelerating, but. But you know, I mean, you know, I'm in an apartment building where the doorman rings me on an intercom that really is a piece of technology that has not essentially changed in, I don't know, 60 years, 80
yeah,
years.
Sure. Sure.
You know, that's what I mean by the impact of technology can be easily overestimated. We're facing some really big technological shifts coming up, but the technological capabilities are far outstripping, you know, the actual adoption. Right? We pretty much have all of the pieces in place for self-driving cars right now, but we're not going to have cars driving themselves for quite some time. We've had planes that could fly themselves better on average, not flawlessly, but human pilots aren't flawless either. The planes flying themselves is by and large better now than pilots flying. But do we have a single plane, a commercial plane, that's flying itself? Not even a FedEx freighter is flying itself yet. So
do we have anyone who wants to get on them? That's the problem.
Well, that's why I started with freighters, right? Because
yeah.
you don't have human passengers. I certainly would. I think some people would. You know, it's humans are not that great at assessing risk. It's one of the reasons why we resist change, even when change would be a good idea. And this is a perfect example, right? You know, the moment a self-driving car has a single accident and three passengers are killed, it's going to set back self-driving cars, you know, for 5 or 10 years. And yet, it may be the case that if cars were driving themselves today, you know, we would lose only maybe 4,000 lives on the highway instead of 44,000 lives. You know, I'm just making these numbers up, but it could very well be the case. And even if it were demonstrably the case, that doesn't mean that people would trust them, because we just don't look at risk in that way. We look at risk in terms of CNN headlines. It's not a great way to evaluate risk, but that's who we are as a people.
But early adopters of some technology, like the web, took everyone by surprise, and then Amazon jumped right in. And other companies did not position themselves, and they're not with us. Or digital photography was invented by Kodak, and they've sat on it so it wouldn't disrupt their film business, and all of a sudden they put them out of business. I mean, so there are some things when they hit, they really get hard.
That's definitely one of the reasons that the impact of technology is, you know, the timeline for the impact of technology is very different from the timeline of the development of the technology, right? It's, you know, individuals are risk-averse, so we resist change. Businesses are risk-averse for various reasons. The Kodak, the ordinary explanation for the Kodak problem is something called the innovator's dilemma, right? At the same time that Kodak should have been switching over to digital technologies, and at least one of its competitors, Fuji, which is probably the most, you know, the closest direct competitor that Kodak had at the time, Fuji did switch over to digital technology and still exists. The problem with Kodak is at the time they should have been switching over, they were making money hand over fist. These were some of the best years that Kodak ever had as a company, were the years after the introduction of the digital technologies that they invented but didn't do anything with, and other people started to do it. And the problem was, you know, to disrupt, you know, something that's making a lot of money is very difficult. To start starving the existing business of resources in favor of something that's, you know, unproven, untried, has no market share or no position in the market yet, very, very difficult. I can name only a few companies that are consistently able to change direction like that. IBM is one of them. It's kind of remarkable what IBM has done over the years in terms of, you know, giving up a disk drive business, for example, that was a third of the company. a third of the profits of the company. And they sold it. They were just like, we don't see an actual future for this in the long run, and we're going to get out while the getting is good, while somebody is going to give us a lot of money for it because it's making money hand over fist. They did that with personal computers, right? They sold that business to they sold off the laptops to Lenovo, and at the time a lot of people were like, you're insane. PCs.
Well, no, they had really lost the PC market. They were being killed by all the other vendors. But they were, DuPont, remember this, where they gave up the computer stores that were awful, and they said, well, it served its purpose. We learned what we wanted to. It was an experiment, and they walked away as though they had done a wonderful job. You know, they were good at that.
Yeah, I mean, but the number of companies that can walk away from successful businesses that don't have a real future is a pretty short list.
Yeah.
And you know, IBM is doing it again today. They're you know, they've made a $1 billion bet on the Watson artificial intelligence capabilities that they developed, first for playing chess to beat the human chess champion, and then for Jeopardy to beat the human Jeopardy champion. They've commercialized those technologies, and now they're going all in with them. They're really shifting the company. So
apparently, they've been
10 years from now, that could actually be the dominant business that IBM is in.
Apparently, they've been successful with some of the hospital things they're doing with hospital companies, but they really haven't been able to market the technology very well, and people are concerned about that. But I was so impressed by their videos, even about how they put these things together. How the hardest thing to do, according to them, was not to predict, because what they would do would be they would gather all possible answers, and then they'd evaluate them based on a probability. If they didn't get an over some number 75% of probable correctness, they'd abandon the question. And most of us humans don't even do that, you know.
It's true. We don't even we're not any good at all at assigning even, you know, the probability of, or you know, some sort of confidence rating of you know, to our answers. We don't even try most of the time. I had a friend who in California, in Yosemite. My hobby is rock climbing, and this rock climbing guide in Yosemite plays this game where he climb all day, and he'll ask you, what time do you think it is? And your answer has to have three parts. You have to say what time you think it is, your range, plus or minus 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever, and then your confidence factor, right? What degree of confidence you have. So you could say, you know, 4:30, plus or minus 15 minutes, 80%. You could say 4:35, okay, plus or minus 10 minutes, you know, 70%. And it's a fun game, and there's no scoring. I mean, there's no algorithm for deciding who wins this. Frequently, both guesses are correct. But it's just a fun game to play because we don't ever think that way, and we really should do it more often.
According to their video and stuff that I've read on, the hardest thing they have to do is understanding the question. They have to parse every one of the names they can recognize and then try to see how they hang together to what are you asking. And that's interesting.
Yeah, and just like what category should the answer be? Should the answer be a city? Should it be a person? Should it be this? Should it be that? It's pretty remarkable what they did for Jeopardy. And then applying it to specific fields is, as you say, incredibly difficult. You know, the press releases say we're now going to, you know, work on medical diagnosis, and then you delve into the story and talk to some people, and it turns out, you know, they're applying it to diagnosis only, to oncology only, and then specific types of cancers only that lend themselves to the sort of analysis that Watson can do, where it can read a million pages of medical literature and work with doctors to refine its knowledge base, and all it can do right now is you know, assist a doctor in a diagnosis of, you know, maybe three different types of cancer. But it's a start, and if it can tell a doctor something that the doctor, you know, didn't know, that can make a huge difference to a patient outcome. You know, if Watson can look at, you know, hold in its database, you know, a million oncology scans, and here's the millionth and first, this doctor's patient, and look and say, here are four scans that look exactly like that scan. That's something a human cannot do.
Yeah.
A human doctor couldn't do it in 100 years. You know, and then the doctor can take those four and say, okay, what were the patient's problems? What were the patient's treatments? What were the patient's outcomes? And really, you know more about how to deal with this new patient. And that's really the future of the Watson technology. It's humans doing what humans still do better, machines doing what machines now do better, and working together. Go ahead.
In some cases, it's not only the technology, it's the reluctance and the concern with liability. A friend of mine, a good deal older, he's been retired from IBM for a number of years, but he was an AI guy. He said it took him 25 years to be able to understand, to have the computer read EKGs and make a prediction based on the thing of what was wrong. And then it had to be so couched that it's possible this is the best analysis rather than this is it. And it's because they're afraid of all being sued, you know. And it was very interesting how he talked about how that it was difficult. The one thing it did for him was when he was after a first heart attack, when he had another heart attack, and he hadn't been diagnosed with a heart attack, and the doctor showed him the EKG and gave him his analysis, and this fellow said, "You missed something," because he knew how to read an EKG.
The liability thing is a very big deal. It's right now the thing that is going to be holding us up with self-driving cars. If a self-driving car is involved in an accident, even if it's not the self-driving car's fault, how do you assess liability? And if it is the self-driving car's fault in some measure, and most accidents are, some amount of fault to this party and some amount of fault to that party. Is it the car manufacturer? Is it the software author? And if Mercedes was using some software that was open source, do you have to go to that guy who wrote the particular routines involved? What liability is the insurance company willing to pick up? The car manufacturer? It's a big question, but I honestly think that we're going to work those questions out. The genius of American enterprise probably rests in several things, but one of them is the ability to say this is just better, and to remove all the obstacles in the way of it. That's really what American business has always been able to, what American society has always been able to do. The rules around credit cards were very onerous, and credit cards were not used very much in the very early years. And everybody just looked and said, this is just going to be too useful. We have to streamline this. We have to simplify this. We have to make this easier to do. And today you can buy gas and not even sign anything. And that's the genius of our system. For better or for worse, we do this. We're just pragmatists, and we're going to figure it out with self-driving cars as well. We're going to figure out the liability.
And being able to expand the credit cards into debit cards where there wasn't any real risk for either party, and right. They were just even more useful, you know?
Yeah, we're going to figure it out. And there will be accidents, and there will be liability, and it'll be okay. And hopefully the number of deaths and injuries on the road will diminish, because honestly the cars are better already at driving themselves than we are overall.
The next time I've seen in a professional capacity was with the ACM and then the IEEE. Were there any intervening positions before I found you next? After Elsevier was
No, that was pretty much it. I went from Elsevier to ACM, and they were looking for somebody who, had both numbers and letters, right? And they needed somebody who was an editor, but somebody who understood the technologies that was being written about. So I took a job there editing a small magazine called Interactions. It was the leading magazine around for human-computer interaction and usability. And I was also charged with starting other magazines. I did start one other, something called Networker, that's still around. The idea, and this was in the mid-90s, was networking is going to become more and more important, and individual standalone PCs are going to give way to networked computers, and we should have a magazine that sort of tracks that evolution. and that's what Networker was about. It was a very nice little publication. We had Networkers of the World Unite was its slogan. We hired a freelance art director who gave the magazine a kind of sort of neo-Soviet realist look to it, in keeping with the Workers of the World Unite kind of theme. It was a nice magazine. But it was after about 5 years there, it was time to move on, and I went to IEEE. And IEEE Spectrum, which is it's kind of an anomalous publication. It's an obscure magazine in some ways. It's not on many newsstands. A lot of people have never heard of it, but it has a circulation of about 500,000, which is about the same as Scientific American. It's right now perhaps the leading technology magazine in the world as far as sort of general interest technologies are concerned, and it was a really, really, really great place to work. A collection of colleagues that I couldn't have imagined, and a charter to write about any technology that was interesting enough to be written about. It's a great place. It's still a great place.
During those years, you also began the master's degree in creative nonfiction at the New School, where you had a course or two with a friend of mine, Susan Cheever, who recently wrote to me that you were one of her favorite students. What made you decide to go back to school, and what were the benefits of the program?
I had been at ACM and then at IEEE initially, more of an editor than a writer. And the two are very, very different skills, as it turns out. And then I took a features beat at Spectrum. I was the internet and telecommunications writer. And, honestly, it's you can learn on your own how to write, reviews and news pieces and, really anything under maybe 1,000 words. Is pretty manageable for most people. But when you get into feature writing, when you're talking about writing about a single subject, 3,000, 4,000 words, it's more than you can hold in your head. It's more than you can organize intuitively. And it just takes too long if you do it without any training. So I decided I just needed to know more about the writing process in general, and the New School had a very nice program for creative nonfiction. Susan Cheever was certainly my favorite instructor there. I had her first semester as my workshop teacher. Now, oddly enough, she was just transitioning to nonfiction herself. At that time, she started out writing novels, and her last several books have been nonfiction works. I liked her so much. I asked her to be my advisor for my master's thesis. She's just a wonderful person to work with, and the program there is a very good one. The nonfiction side is completely dominated by memoir right now, which didn't really meld. too much with my work interests, but it didn't matter that much. It was still a great place to learn how to write. And it's a funny thing, John. You do a lot of teaching and you work with students who are in degree programs, and I'm sure some of them come to you and say, "What exactly am I paying for here? Right? I'm paying a lot of money, and what am I really getting for it? There's just this." A few contact hours a week per course. It just doesn't seem to add up too much, and that's certainly true with the New School. When you look at the numbers, the number of hours that you're in class and the amount of time that you spend in general in the program and the amount of money that you pay for a degree, it's very hard to make those numbers work. And yet, I can tell you that it was a terrific investment for me, and I can't explain how it made me a much better writer. but it made me a much, much, much better writer. I can now edit very good writers and improve their writing. And I can write features myself that don't need much editing by other really, really good editors. And that's all due to the program, and I can't really explain how.
It was easier with my students when I was teaching during the years that I was teaching heavy technology stuff, and I was teaching full time at Monroe College. In the 90s, they could walk down Wall Street with the sign IT major and bang, be pulled off the streets. Now it's very difficult because there are, as you know, and we'll talk about that in a bit, there are many, many fewer jobs, and it's very difficult for these students to come out with a degree and then find out that they can be working in one of the stores that sells furniture or whatever. You know, it's very difficult.
It is very difficult. Yeah, it's and that's a shame. And we all have that experience. And I think that's just going to become more and more true no matter what people are trained in. And we could talk about some of the reasons why.
Do you also? What was your master's thesis on, Steve?
My hobby I mentioned is rock climbing, and you know, there is the advice write what you know. There's also the right advice write what you don't know, and I think actually both pieces of advice are very good. So I started writing because the nonfiction program at the New School, and I think probably everywhere, is dominated by memoir right now, as opposed to, for example, long form feature writing of the sort that the Wall Street Journal or Esquire, Vanity Fair are still publishing. Because the program is dominated by memoir, I just started writing memoir. It was just easier to swim downstream rather than up. And I started writing about my rock climbing friends and my rock climbing experiences. And so I came up with about six pieces that would be maybe a half of a book if I were to write a book, a memoir type book, which I'm probably not going to do, but there it is. And there's also a sort of essay component to the thesis, and I wrote about why rock climbing is so hard to write about. As it turns out, many people, mostly climbers, try and write about climbing in a way for non-climbers, and they very rarely succeed in coming up with something that's of any interest to anybody but fellow rock climbers. My essay component explored why that's the case. There's a lot of jargon. It's highly technical, as it turns out, rock climbing that is, and it's very hard for these sort of non-trained writers to write about climbing in a non-technical way. I tried to do it in my six pieces. That was one of the challenges I set for myself, and I think I mostly succeeded. But really, you'd have to be a trained writer to even have a shot at succeeding.
Now, growing up in Queens, how did you get into rock climbing?
Via, you know, hiking and then eventually backpacking. I sort of just naturally fell in love with the outdoors, I guess, as a kid. And once I was an adult with a job and a car, I started driving up to the Adirondacks, and I fell in love with that place, and I'm still in love there. Every time I go, I just feel renewed. And I started subscribing to hiking and backpacking magazines. Same thing as with computer programming. It's the magazines have always saved my life one way or another. And there was an ad for Outward Bound, and I filled out a postcard and got a brochure and took it Outward Bound, and It was a 12-day program, but there was a 3-day component within that of climbing and rappelling.
And my son did one of them in high school, his whole class, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember David Levine from NIAC. He got into spelunking, and he took off about 50 pounds so he could fit through the cave entrance. I thought that was very, very interesting that he made that kind of a commitment to it, you know?
There's a lot of similarity between a lot of people do both. A lot of people start as cavers or spelunkers and end up climbing, and a few people go the other way. My regular rock climbing partner, a friend of mine, named Mark, he started out in a college outdoor program at Rutgers, but they were mainly cavers at the time, and he started with that. But you got to climb out of the cave, and that's how he started climbing. That's not surprising.
You also host a podcast show, TechWise Conversations. Tell us about that.
I was making yet another transition within Spectrum, within IEEE Spectrum, where I went from being a feature writer to I took over a section of the magazine and was editing freelancers, and then I switched over to the digital side. And we were looking for things that would increase traffic on the site, and we had done a certain amount of radio work with an old NPR hand as a consultant, but the NPR style radio is very resource intensive. The end products are just fantastic, but they require a lot of resources to produce even a short piece. And so we were producing short pieces, but one of my colleagues on the digital side, a guy by the name of Harry Goldstein, he turned to me one day and he said, you know, there's an 80-20 rule here to be had. We can get 80% of the bang of those radio pieces for 20% of the effort. I'm just sure we can. And he and I sort of devised a podcast format that did just that. And it was probably more like a 90-10 rule, as it turned out. And I, toward the end, I was producing two podcasts a week of about, they were generally between 12 and 17 minutes in length, on a really wide range of technology topics. And it was pretty popular. Toward the end, it was more than 5% of the site traffic, and I had the average podcast was being listened to by close to 10,000. The best podcasts were being listened to by a quarter of a million people. So
terrific.
It was very satisfying, and I would like to start doing podcasts again. Maybe in conjunction with Spectrum folks, because it's a really wonderful format, as you yourself well know, John. For me, it turned out to be probably the best format I ever worked in. It combined writing and then on the spot, really fast thinking. Our podcasts were not live like this one is, but we tried to do a minimum of editing, and so we tried to get things right the first time, and we did very little editing of them. And to get a lot of information packed into an average of about 15 minutes is pretty challenging in and of itself. So and then there's a certain amount of almost acting, and I have a little acting in my family background. I'm not a very good actor myself. But you do, you know, you prepare and then you read a question. I was reading questions in a way that I tried to make sound natural and spontaneous when it was really written a week ago. I've talked to people, regular listeners, and they're astonished when I tell them that I write those questions out in advance because it doesn't sound like it. It just turned out to be in every way a really good format for me to work in.
Who was the NPR guy who was working with you?
It was a woman. I'm trying to think of her name now.
The reason I asked the question is there was a fellow who did some work for us who was one of the really radio, both on VAI and then on NPR, Larry Josephson, who had also been a system program with IBM. He had a very interesting background.
I actually know him slightly. That was not the person.
Okay.
But Larry's a great guy. Yeah, it's the NPR way of doing things. We Spectrum is still doing stuff for NPR from time to time, and they've done that very successfully, and it's a lot of fun. I did one piece that we kind of designed for This American Life that they never picked up because they couldn't make it ever part of a 1 hour. You know, they have like entire 1 hour themes, and this piece never really lent itself to other pieces in a theme. But it was one of the best things I think I've ever done personally. It was the technology behind the Mason-Dixon line, it turns out there was quite a bit of technology behind it, and quite a bit of technology used in the current era to assess the accuracy of the Mason-Dixon line, which people for 300 years just assumed was, or 250 years was you know, dead on, and then a question came up about maybe it's not, and maybe the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, which is the Mason-Dixon line, maybe it's not even accurate relative to the original deeds that were granted by the King of England, and so the question came up, and technology was used to measure. It was a really wonderful story. I went down and visited the Mason-Dixon line and talked to one of the guys who worked on the assessment of its accuracy. I'll tell you why I love this piece so much. There's a song by the singer Mark Knopfler about the Mason-Dixon line, and I was listening to the song one day, and my wife had just bought me an iPod, and so I was really hearing the lyrics for the first time of this song because I was listening with earphones and to my iPod, and I was listening to the lyrics, and I'm like, this is an incredibly detailed historical account of the Mason-Dixon line. I wonder if it's all true. And I got to the office, and I got on Google, and I started verifying all of the facts. And Mark Knopfler got, with one exception, every fact right about this. And I was like, this is a fascinating story. And, of course, once you start Googling, you never know where you're going to end up. And so I started to find all the technology angles. And so technology was involved in the impetus, an early iPod. It was probably my favorite piece ever, and I finally did put it on the air myself as part of the podcast series.
A lot of people don't realize how far north the Mason-Dixon line is. They all think it's down around Virginia someplace, and it goes through where Barbara and I go on vacation most years is to North Wildwood, New Jersey, which is actually below the Mason-Dixon line.
That's correct. Yeah, it's people don't understand that, like, South Jersey is in some sense part of the southern United States because it's below where the Mason-Dixon line would go if it were extended eastward. The whole story is pretty fascinating. The Mason and Dixon met 10 years earlier when the Royal Society assigned them to the same ship to take some measurements for something called the Transit of Venus, which was going to tell them, the Royal Society, that is, a lot of information about the actual size of the Earth, for example, and a bunch of other things. They met there, and then they were hired by Lord Calvert, Lord Baltimore, who owned Maryland, and William Penn, who owned Pennsylvania, to settle this border dispute between them. And first they ran the border, the western border of Delaware, which runs north-south, and then the top of that is the starting point of the Mason-Dixon line. And they were their charter was to run the line due west until the mountains. That's what the King's Charter said. And they got to the Allegheny Mountains and what we now call Ohio and finally stopped. But they ran a 200-mile long line, which, by the way, just to give people the punchline, is phenomenally accurate.
Well, South Jersey, when we first started going there, should have been part of the South because it was one of the most virulent conservative and almost racist. There was a Christian broadcaster named Carl Madonick, who was, no, it wasn't Madonick, it was Carl something or other, who was attacking everything. And my brother in the early to mid 50s was in a religious order, and they went on vacation down there to Cape May, and they were told not to wear their religious garb around because it was so virulent anti-Catholic. And they weren't very big on Jews either at that time.
I was sort of linguist interviewed about North Jersey accents versus South Jersey accents, and if you take a South Jersey speaker and surround his sound bites with sound bites of people from the actual South, people from Mississippi or Alabama or something, people will have trouble discerning which was the South Jersey.
Really?
Sound bite. Yeah, it's there is some surprising similarities there.
Well, in the late 1920s or early 1930s, Asbury Park had the largest KKK parade north of Mississippi in the country, which was fairly interesting.
Interesting, scary, yeah.
After 12 years at the IEEE, you moved on to your present position. What made you move, and what is the present position?
So I was headhunted for this. I'd finally, you know, pretty much created the perfect job for myself at Spectrum. About half of it was the podcast, and then I was editing. I was sort of in charge of the blog editing as well, and the blogs are a huge portion of the IEEE Spectrum website activity. I got an email one day that was about two sentences long from a person I'd never heard of at an organization I'd never heard of, but the email said, Bob Lucky and David Reed say we should talk. Do you have any time to talk?
Not bad company.
Not bad company at all. So Bob Lucky was the head of telecommunications research for a while at Bell Labs during its heyday. After the breakup, he was the president of Telcordia, which was one of the spinoff companies. He did that until his retirement a while back. He's got a couple of patents to his name. One of them for the adaptive equalizer is something that's pretty much built into every piece of audio equipment ever made in the last 40 years, I guess. He's quite a guy. David Reed is a long-time internet architect and technologist. When people debate network neutrality, which is this idea that that the big internet providers, companies like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast, should treat all traffic equally. That's the network neutrality principle. When people debate that, they always end up at this one article that was written in the mid-80s on something called the end-to-end principle that describes sort of the architecture of the Internet as it evolved to the point of the mid-80s and today, that described the architecture in a way that nobody had really seen it as before, where all of the intelligence is at the endpoints and as little intelligence as possible is in the middle, unlike a telephone network. That article was written by David Reed, long story short, and the number of internet protocols that have his name attached to it is...
He's very bright. He was also part of the Software Arts Group with Bricklin and Frankston. I don't know
That's
if
right.
he was ever on board full-time, because he was also a professor at MIT. But I got to know him casually through them, and it was obvious how bright he was.
Yeah, he's quite
Bob
bright.
Lucky, I heard speak years ago. The conference board put on a show for presidents of companies. It was they were bringing them in from out of town back in the early days of when IBM had just gotten into the business, and IBM, Hewlett Packard, and Apple helped self-support it. And the idea was that the presidents of corporations had not they signed the checks, but didn't know much about these personal computers. And they were going to show them. So we had to talk the night before with dinner with all these people, and they said, look, these people, don't overwhelm them with technology. Just explain to them how things work in relation to what they do and talk business. We said, fine. So the next morning, I'm sitting at breakfast with the president of National Gypsum. This was all in the World Trade Center. And then he says, you know, I shouldn't even be here. I really don't know much about this technology. He said, I'm going to be bored or I'm going to be overwhelmed. I said, no, we had this dinner last night, blah, blah, blah. The keynote speaker was Bill Lowe from IBM, and Bill Lowe had obviously been briefed badly by his subordinates. In addition to being a boring speaker, the room went dark, and they started showing slides, and the slides and him talking about system network design of technology infrastructure and words like this, and they were showing all software that was garbage software from IBM. They never mentioned 123 that all these people had. And I could see the eyes rolling and people looking for the door. And I said, oh, my God, this is a disaster. Well, the lunchtime speaker was either Alan Kay or Bob Lucky. One of them was the first day, one was the next day. And they really brought this back together because they were great speakers, you know.
But it's funny that you mentioned Alan Kay's name. It turns out the connection between Bob Lucky and David Reed, and the reason this strange person was writing me using their names, was they're on the advisory board of this organization called TTI Vanguard, which is a company that puts on small sort of boutique technology-oriented conferences, five a year, for senior C-level executives at sort of Fortune 500 companies, and there are about 75 companies, either actually Fortune 500 companies or similarly sized organizations around the world, some government organizations. And
by C-level, do you mean CEO, CIO, that type?
Yes.
Okay.
CTO, Chief Strategy Officers, whatever. And and so Bob Lucky and David Reed were members of the advisory board. Alan Kay, who probably more than any other single individual was responsible for that computer that we talked about earlier, the Xerox Star, developed by Xerox Park, that Steve Jobs, after 2 years, finally got a peek at.
And for object-oriented programming and everything else, yeah.
And the world's very first tablet designed by him, yep. Something called the Dynabook. How many years before the iPad?
1978, he wrote that article for Byte magazine. That's a dynamo.
Amazing. So there's the three people on the advisory board. Gordon Bell, who sort of invented the mini computer at Digital Equipment in the 1970s, is also on this advisory board. Len Kleinrock, who no single person can lay claim to inventing the Internet, but his claim is probably at least as strong as anybody else's. He developed the mathematics behind packet switching.
Okay.
And a bunch of other businesses, 16 technologists, some young guys as well. Eben Upton, for example, the guy who came up with the Raspberry Pi, sort of $35 computer on a
right.
chip. Is on the advisory board as well. So the previous sort of editorial director of this organization was going to retire, and the email that I got was from the head of the organization looking for a new editorial director, and she had asked at an advisory board meeting. She said, "We think this is a job for a journalist. You guys have worked with a lot of journalists in your time. Is there anybody you can think of who would be good as the editorial director for the conference company?" And it turns out two people mentioned my name. Once my name came up, Gordon Bell, who has absolutely no memory at all, he's still a genius, still one of the world's great investors and assessors of technology, but no memory. He's like, oh, yeah, he'd be good. Of course, I wrote the definitive profile of him in the mid-2000s.
The husband of Gwen Bell, who founded the Computer Museum.
That's right, and was a president of ACM at the time that I worked there. And it turns out no other person was named by more than one board member. So that was pretty flattering to me, and it made me sort of a prime candidate for the job. And when I looked into this organization, I was kind of astonished. I had never heard of it. That's not that surprising. But nobody at Spectrum had ever heard of it. That was a little more surprising. I'm a member in good standing of the Internet Press Guild, which has, I don't know, maybe 100 people on its mailing list active at any given time. I put out a question there, and not a single person there had ever heard of TGI Vanguard. And the reason is the meetings are off the record. They're closed to the press. Every once in a while, a member of the press is actually a speaker, and even then, they're enjoined not to. They can stay for the whole conference, but they don't write about what they heard and saw, at least not directly. If they get an idea for a story that they follow up later on, that's another matter. But the meetings themselves are off the record, and that's why nobody's ever heard of it. When I started looking online at just the parts of the organization that are publicly visible, I was pretty astonished. I was like, I would love to run these conferences. I would love to just attend these conferences. They've been doing this for 22 years now, and I started to play a game with myself. I would look for my own feature stories. I would look to see when TTI Vanguard had a talk about that topic, and time and again, the TTI Vanguard talk beat my story by months or maybe even a year in a couple of cases. And the speaker at the conference would invariably be one of the key experts that the article cited. And not just my articles. I started looking at my colleagues' articles as well, and probably more than half the time TTI Vanguard had a session on exactly that topic, with just the right person that you would want based on the article, time and again. It's a remarkable organization, a remarkable set of conferences.
I was hired
in last August. I've been there just about a year now.
It's funny. It reminded me of a story. The biggest audience I ever had speaking was at a Macworld conference in Boston, and I was in this auditorium that held about 500 people, and it was packed. Not to hear me, but Gates was on the panel just before, but the panel that I was on was I was running it. It was on how people. They're using technology, doing certain things for education, other things. And one of the coordinators was a woman named Bonnie McBird. And Bonnie McBird wrote the screenplay for a movie you may remember, Tron.
Sure.
And she also, her job, she had a graphics company, a display company, and they went around and they displayed things for John Sculley. They were his display company. And she was extremely vivacious, a good speaker, very sharp, but I had the impression that she didn't know too much about computers. And I said, "No, I was watching her, you know." And she was concerned about getting things hooked up and how did the networks work. And I said, "How was she ever able to write the screenplay for Tron?" Well, at the end of our show, as the thing was emptying out and the curtain went up, her husband came out. I knew him slightly and talked to him for a minute. Her husband's Alan Kay. Then it all rang a bell how she got the technology right.
That's terrific. I don't actually remember too much about that movie, but I do remember that it was surprisingly good on its technology, and very few movies are, right? I mean,
right.
Minority Report is probably the gold standard there, but so many movies just get so many things wrong.
Do also teach at a school that I'm relatively familiar with from my days that I own it. Tell us about the college, the course, and what made you pursue academia.
This is the College of New Rochelle. They have a main campus in New Rochelle, of course, but they have 6 satellite campuses in New York City, and the goal there is to bring College of New Rochelle quality education to some areas that it hit some people that might otherwise not have access to that. So the programs are fairly small, but they're limited to returning students. They have to have tried college once before or dropped out of school or dropped out, in some cases, of high school. They have to be over 21 years old, and many of them are twice that or more, which is part of the appeal for me. I just really enjoy that sort of not just older population, but a mixed population of as many people in their 20s as 50s. And most people are there for professional advancement. They're getting degrees in social work or psychology or the like. Many of them are working at city agencies or places like that where they're doing the job of a manager. They're not getting paid as a manager because they don't have a college degree. But once they get there, they're serious about their education, and they're not just trying to get a degree. They're really putting out a lot of time as well as, in some cases, money. I mean, and many of them are subsidized to some degree, but it's still the money that they pay hurts. And the time hurts. Many of them have two jobs, three jobs at times, and many of them are single parents raising kids. School is a tough thing for them to add to their schedule, and yet they do. And so it's a very rewarding group of people to teach. And I started teaching essay writing. First, they have a very serious writing requirement there of three semesters of six credits each, a four-credit course and a two-credit course each of, and there's a there's an exit exam every semester. You have to pass this test to go on to the next one. And you have to pass all three within your first 2 years. Otherwise you're done. You're not going to go any further until you pass that third one. And it's the four credit courses are all essay writing, and then the two credit courses are things like how to research a paper, or the very first one is something called journal writing, and I've taught that, and it's a lot of fun. The essay writing is a pretty serious course because they come into that first class really having no idea how to put together, you know, even a five-page paper seems daunting to them. I try and convince them that, you know, words are cheap, right? We just, you know, even in the days of typewriters and paper and ink, words were not that expensive. But, you know, once you have a screen of some sort that you can type on, their words are free. So by the end of the course, they're able to write longer papers with sort of ease. But I started doing that, and then they hadn't taught creative writing for a long time, but they decided to revive a course that was still in the catalog. A bunch of students had expressed some interest, and I had a degree in creative writing, and I had already started teaching writing at Gotham Writers Workshop as well. And so I was, I guess, a sort of logical person to teach this first creative writing course. And the first one that I taught was a six-credit course, which is kind of
crazy.
Wow. But it was a terrific group of students. They were thoroughly motivated. Every one of them, you know, just loved to read and loved to write. And it was a self-selecting group of everybody in the school who are the people most interested in becoming better writers. It was about 12 of them, and it was just one of those courses that I'm sure you've had these courses in your career, John, where just like you look back and you're like, even at the time, I knew this is a very special group of kids, and this experience is not going to be replicated for me possibly ever again. It was just a
guys at Monroe College when I had a lot of people who had been Fabulous New York City Board of Education, only minorities, very bright, who weren't encouraged to go to college, and they went out working, and then they found out that they were missing something, and they came back to school. But what they were looking for, their level of expectation was not high, and I was able to place over 100 of them with IBM and place all over the country in Dallas and Raleigh and other places, and people told me, you changed my life, and that was a bigger kick than anything I ever got out of business.
I can imagine. I still get, you know, like Facebook messages from students, and two of them from that creative writing class asked me to their graduation. One of them went on to a master's program in writing at Goddard College, and I wrote one of his letters of recommendation. It's just the amount of joy you can get from the achievement of people that you've helped in some small way is definitely incommensurate with the help that you actually gave them, I think. And it's just so much fun to hear from these guys.
Steve, there was a couple of things I wanted to go over, and we are going to run out of time. I haven't such a good time. I'd like to have get back. I had to have to set a date because I wanted to talk about some of the technology things that you mentioned and that I write about in a weekly column on how technology is changing the world and we're losing jobs and all this. So if we can, I'm going to skip over that. I'm going to stay with writing, but
sure.
I'd like to have you back.
That would be a pleasure.
Okay, now, you mentioned in your note to me that you were trying to turn some novels into screenplays. Are these your novels or the novels of others?
Novels of others. So this was this is a little bit of a long story, but I think it might be of interest. It's I had a strange experience at Spectrum in the early days before my podcast series when we were working with the NPR consultant on regular NPR radio pieces. And that was I had done a story about it was the time of the Olympics. I want to say this was the 2004 Olympics, although that's kind of crazy. But it was whichever Olympics, the Speedo suit was getting a lot of credit for setting world records in swimming, and Speedo had sent around this press release that touted the technologies involved in the construction of the fabric and testing it in a NASA wind tunnel and all of these things, and I looked into it and it was kind of interesting, and I wrote a little news piece for Spectrum about it, and I had drafted maybe 800 words, and I needed to get it down to like maybe 600 words. 550 would have been great to be a news piece at the right size for the magazine for a story of not, you know, huge importance. And but I really wanted to get a piece on Marketplace, which is this public radio show from Minnesota Public Radio that
sure.
You know comes on for a half hour on weeknights, And I talked to the consultant about it, and she's like, well, you know, no Marketplace piece, certainly not this one, is going to be more than 2.5 minutes. And 2.5 minutes is maybe 350 words, maybe 375, but certainly no more than that. And so you have to get your story down to that. And you got to do it really fast because, you know, I have to pitch it to Marketplace by such and such a date in order to get it on this week, and it won't be timely after this. So there I was looking at 800 words, and now I suddenly have to cut it to 375. And you know, I mean, any piece of writing, you know, can be cut maybe 15% without any problem at all, quite frankly. I mean, any piece of writing that the author thinks is ready for publication can be cut 15%. 20% often, 25%. Now you're probably, for a good writer, getting into the muscle and bone of it and past the fat, but... And, you know, for lousy writers, up to 70%, but, you know. And so this was like a more than 50% cut. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I had to really rethink the piece from scratch. It wasn't a question of what can I get rid of. It's a question of what few things do I want to say? What little piece of this story do I want to make the whole story? And so I did. And I crafted a 350-word piece that... Mm-hmm. was pitched to Marketplace, and they didn't take it. So, but there I was. I still needed to write a version for the news section. And now, instead of looking at 800 words and trying to get it down to 550, I had a 350-word piece, and I was swimming in space. I could now add this back, and I could add that back, and, you know, still be in my 550-word, you know, allotment. It was just wonderful. And it got me to thinking that when you cross from one genre to the next, in this case from magazine writing to radio writing, it's a very liberating experience. And so I started experimenting with other cross-genre endeavors. And the one I settled on as being a lot of fun, just as a kind of hobby, was going from novels to screenplays. And I really, really learned a lot about structure and, I'm trained as a writer, I'm experienced as a writer, I'm a professional writer, but screenwriting was almost completely self-taught, and I learned so much about both of them in the course of trying to translate a novel to a screenplay. I found, for example, novels that I loved, just really adored, when I translated them to screenplays, I found all of their flaws. Like, this doesn't make any sense, and this is completely irrelevant, and this would make more sense if it were turned into this. And it's also, novel to screenplay is a huge exercise in compression. The number of words in a novel is,
Sure. I mean,
technically starts at 50,000 and typically is more like 70 to 85,000 words. And I hope non-writers listening to this are not appalled by this kind of seeing how the sausage is made, all of this talk about word counts. But a screenplay, can easily be only 20,000 words.
My son is a screenwriter out of NYU's Tisch School, and what he's been writing for the last 10 years have been for television, but it's a whole different life. Now, it's interesting. What he tells me is that one of the reasons that he and his friends have chosen to write for television is that writing for the movies, the writers just push the background, and it's a director's game, and on television, it's a writer's game,
for a couple of reasons, and one of them, which he may not be enjoying these benefits, or maybe he is, but the reason we seem to be, in the opinion of many people, in a golden age of television, is that we're now liberated from the 22 minute episodes per year. Kind of format, or the two-hour movie format of movies, a story can be as long or as short as it needs to be.
Yeah, the one that just wrapped up, this murder in the first, took a whole season to tell one murder investigation, for instance.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, the killing, took two seasons for one murder investigation. But, The Wire... David Simon and his collaborators mapped out, they didn't write all of the episodes in advance, but they
Right.
mapped out 5 years of stories at 12 episodes per season in the beginning. And this isn't super new. I mean, this goes back to, adapting Roots from a book by Alex Haley into a TV miniseries. So instead of making it a two-hour movie and leaving 90% of the story out, they made it a three-night thing and could tell as much of the story as needed to be told. Lonesome Dove, honestly, one of the great books of the 20th century and one of the great movie experiences of the 20th century.
Yep.
Is, I don't know, whatever it is, 6 hours of film. So... So the miracle of television today is that, you can have three whole seasons for Deadwood, you could have two seasons for The Killing, you could have five seasons for The Wire, and whatever your story is, just tell it naturally instead of trying to squeeze it into a format.
Had a three-day thing for the ABC Family Channel called Samurai Girl, and what they did was they did two episodes. So it's a night for a three-day weekend, and it was something I hadn't seen done before. It was very interesting because you got the whole story compressed very quickly, huh?
Right. That's interesting. I do though find that the constraints of a format for me are more of a plus than a minus. So the being forced to compress a story into 120 screenplay pages, which is already fewer pages than a novel, and screenplays are very, very strictly formatted, and the pages are roughly 50% white space, the way they're formatted. So when you add those two factors, the fewer number of pages and the more white space, you end up with screenplay being maybe 20-25% of the words of the novel that you're adapting. And it forces you to really look at the novel and figure out what the heart of the story is and what the extraneous portions are, in a way that novel writers are not constrained to do, unfortunately, for them. And I showed an adapted screenplay of a novel to the novelist. I've done it twice, actually, where I didn't ask for permission in advance. I just did it as an exercise for myself and then showed them the result afterwards. And they were kind of amazed. One was a play and the other was a movie. And they were both amazed at
Have you marketed them at all?
I haven't. I've thought about it. There's one, which is an adaptation of a classic science fiction story by Damon Knight called A for Anything. And
okay.
I got permission from his widow to, after the fact, I showed it to her. She was pretty amazed. And I got permission to try and do something with that, but I haven't really done that much with it.
Well, I have much more to talk about the future of writing, but I'm going to put that off to the next time, too. We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and very productive life. What else might you like our audience to know about Steve Cherry?
I don't know. I do think that there's one respect in which my life is a little bit ahead of the curve in one respect, and we're going to talk about second show that you've kindly invited me to do. We're going to talk about sort of jobs and the future of careers, but one thing that I find remarkable is that you know, people are living longer and working longer, and the days of, you know, working for the railroad company or IBM for 35 or 50 years and getting a gold watch and calling it quits are behind us as a culture, and people are going to routinely have multiple careers. My own daughter graduated college only a few years ago, and she's already back in graduate school trying to invent her next career or be ready for it. And I think that's going to become routine. So I think that my own life has been emblematic of a trend in a couple of ways. One is multiple sort of successive careers, and the other is taking a passion and turning it into a career. And I think both of those things, for reasons that would be fun to explore in our next show, I think both of those are going to become much more common.
Agreed. Thank you very much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you, John.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by critic John Simon and Professor Oren Levin Waldman, and occasional pieces by former Representative Lee Hamilton and Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at open.salon.com/blogs/JohnMack13. Send any comments or questions about any of this, including our shows, to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in the book. Tune in next week for the Reverend Al Neese. Until then, as he's the Sandy Old Neighbor, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady.